It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. America's great feast day is right ahead. And if I'm honest with you, I can never really tell if Thanksgiving is the purest and best holiday because it's simple. It's all about family and food, or if it's the most complicated holiday because you have to deal with all that family and food. But either way, we have a great show for you this week. We have a grandma's secret recipe, a look at how the holiday plays out for families from different cultures, hacks to make it all easier, and, well, something to drink if things don't go as planned. But everyone always says the sides are the best part of the meal, so let's start there. First Thanksgiving was full of what the colonists probably would have called Indian food. Corn, squash, lobster, you know, all the things the Wampanoag tribe showed them how to grow and eat. But fast forward 400 years, and I'm here to tell you that you might want to put some literal Indian food on your Thanksgiving table. Vikram Sundaram is the chef of the restaurant Rasika in Washington, D.C., by way of London and Mumbai. He's been cooking his amazing Indian food in the U.S. for over a decade, and he's made incredible dishes inspired by American Thanksgiving. Many of them are captured in his new book, Rasika, and I met up with Vikram and his co-author, David Hagedorn, in Washington, in what I can guarantee was the best-smelling radio studio in history. So, Chef, David, thanks so much for joining us today.
A pleasure to be here.
I'm actually joining you because I'm actually in your town. You're not in my town. And thank you for bringing all this food. It smells incredible.
Thank you.
So, David, you've worked in food media for a while now, and so you understand the essential problem of every November issue of every magazine, right? Which is, what are we going to do this year, right? Because everyone says, I'm so bored of Thanksgiving. Give me something new, something to look forward to.
Well, actually, I know it from three sides, having had a career as a chef for 25 years and having to come up with Thanksgiving menus in my restaurants. And I have my family over every year, so I have to do it there. And now we have this opportunity working with Vikram, which was tremendous fun, to really think of Thanksgiving in another way, which he helped me do completely.
Yeah.
Early on, one of the first recipes we tested was the cranberry chutney, and it was such an inspiration. It just really spoke to Thanksgiving. And we did all of the recipes first and then went back later to do the head notes. And so it just made it so obvious to me how many of these dishes were appropriate for the Thanksgiving table. And I was able to speak to that in the head notes with Vikram, you know, kind of cueing that so that we could maybe think of having Americans think of Thanksgiving in a different way.
Yeah.
And thinking of Indian food in a different way, for that matter.
Yeah. And then, Chef Vikram, you are not from the United States. You came here via London from India.
That's right.
And in your cooking, you've actually found yourself inspired to some degree by traditional American Thanksgiving flavors.
Definitely. I mean, when I came to America, you know, I wasn't aware so much of Thanksgiving. But obviously, living here for the last 12 years, Thanksgiving is a very big holiday here. So every year we came up with dishes for Thanksgiving at the restaurant. And so we put some of them on the menu, like the samosas with the cranberry chutney, the smoked butternut squash, bhartha, the green bean chili garlic. So there are some of the dishes we have, which are in the book, which can be eaten at Thanksgiving.
Yeah. So you've brought some of these dishes.
That's right.
And this is really all an excuse for me to get to eat your food.
Perfect.
So can we taste our way through some of these and you can tell us about the inspiration and how you made them?
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to start with this is sweet potato samosa.
That's right.
With cranberry chutney.
Uh-huh.
This samosa is like a crispy dumpling. You've filled almost like a phyllo dough or like a spring roll wrapper type of pastry. You've tied it off with a scallion and you fried it so the edges come up like a beautiful cloth. All right, I'm going in. Oh, dude, that's good.
Now again, cranberries is one of the essential ingredients during Thanksgiving. And we made a chutney with it where we put spices like cinnamon, cloves, cardamom, green chilies.
Mm.
And of course, the chutney, when we were testing the recipe, and Vikram would come over to my house so that we could test everything on a home kitchen stove instead of a professional one. And by the way, that made me very popular in my neighborhood. Everyone knew when he was there, and everyone knew when he left because they were standing by our back door. When we first tested the chutney, which was pretty early on, it was a revelation for me because this just popped with flavor so much. Yeah. I thought, this needs to be marketed. You need to jar it and sell it for Thanksgiving. It's such a revelation, especially next to a turkey. To put some of that with a piece of turkey and gravy, it's amazing.
Yeah, you can really taste sweetness, but that bright, bright, bright tartness from the cranberries, but also this little bit of heat.
That's right.
It sort of sails through it.
Right. Can you imagine that kick of heat on Thanksgiving table? It's something so unusual. It's something not found.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with Thanksgiving is it's brown food and white food, right?
Right.
It's delicious. It's very, it's sort of one note. It's a one big, warm, comforting hug, but that's kind of all you get. So this is a little bit of a, you know, this is like when your aunt comes and slaps you across the face a little bit. It's like, I love you.
Yeah, the Indian spices do give it a third dimension, you can say, to the Thanksgiving meal.
Yeah. So let's talk about your butternut squash bartha, because I think, you know, squash and pumpkin are such a traditional thing as well here, but this is a different idea of it. How do you make this?
Yes, now bartha is traditionally made with eggplant. It's called Bengan bartha. Mm-hmm. But obviously, being Thanksgiving, butternut squash has to be on the table. So we made a smoked butternut squash mash. That's what it is. Mm. So it's cooked with onions, tomatoes, ginger, green chilies, and you roast the butternut squash. And then you cook the butternut squash with the onion tomato masala. And once that is done, we smoke it.
Mm.
So you can get the smoke flavor in the butternut squash.
This is like, can we cancel the recording right now? Because I'm just going to sit here and eat the rest of this. It's amazing.
The smoking technique is actually quite brilliant. You take a briquette and you get it hot on the stove. You can do it on an electric stove or a gas stove. And you take, while that's heating up, you take a piece of aluminum foil, heavy-duty aluminum foil, and on that you put some cloves. And then once the briquette is ash hot, you put the foil on top of the squash and then with the cloves, and then you put the briquette on, and then you pour ghee or melted butter over it, which creates the smoke, and you put the lid on and just let the lid stay on until the smoke dissipates, which is about 10 minutes or so. It's such a brilliant smoking technique. They use it for the dal at Rasika, which is a life-altering experience once you tasted that dal.
Okay, hearing you describe that smoking technique is changing my life for now, because I have to say, when I taste it, I'm like, oh, the flavor is so beautiful. I get the spice, I get that onion, I get that little crunch from onion that's in the mashed sweet potato, which you don't kind of expect. But the smoke was so interesting because it didn't taste like a typical wood smoke. It tasted that sort of burnt oil flavor, like if you're cooking Chinese food in a wok.
That's right. Exactly. Really stir fry. That's right.
Yeah, you get the little bit of that flavor in there, and that's because you're actually smoking the oil. Like you're burning the oil just a little bit to get that flavor in the. Oh my God, that's amazing. Okay, so the green beans, chili, garlic. I mean, these look like green beans chopped up into little bits that you've stir fried and now almost coated in this paste of onions and aromatics. Let me get in here.
Again, now in the context of Thanksgiving, green bean casserole is always, again, on the Thanksgiving table. So it's caramelized onions, burned garlic, chili flakes, green chilies, ginger, and then the green beans are tossed in it.
Yeah. This is, like, green bean casserole is no fun compared to this.
It's different, definitely. But that's, you know, as I said, Indian food does add spice to the table.
Yeah, but it's not just, the heat is very prominent, but it's not just the heat, it's the fact that you get all that caramelized flavor from the garlic and the ginger.
And as a recipe developer, what's appealing to me, especially in this day and age of people not wanting to spend much time on things, is that you can blanch the green beans ahead of time, even the day before, and then the dish comes together really quickly at the end.
And this is great too, because the kind of thing where everyone's like, how do I time it? How do I time everything?
Right.
How do I time everything?
That's right.
I've got this turkey cooking for 3 hours, and I got to do this other thing when people get here, and this is like 30 seconds later, you're in.
With a real brightness to it, too, which
yeah.
is so appealing.
Yeah, so many foods in Thanksgiving are long-cooked, slow-cooked, or have been cooked a while ago and have been sort of hanging around, so to do something at the last minute, you can add that freshness to the table, too.
Exactly.
And, Chef, you wanted to tell us for sure about your stuffed dates with the saffron chili beurre blanc.
Yes, I mean, that's, again, a fun way of putting dates on the table because, you know, the Italians have they stuff with mascarpone. But here we've stuffed the dates with goat cheese, with some chili powder, chaat masala, which gives it a bite to it. And then we grilled the dates on a tawa, which is a flat griddle. And we made a saffron chili beurre blanc to go with it.
That doesn't sound like a problem.
And for people who don't like a goat cheese, you can use paneer instead, for example.
Talk. It's so good.
What a rapturous look.
It's so good.
I have to admit, I was a little bit skeptical because I like dates fine, but I'm not a huge dates fan. Because often to me, they're too sweet.
That's right.
They're sickly sweet. The stuffing with the cheese adds a little bit of a layer of mitigates the sweetness. And I'm sort of fascinated by it. Like, there's almost a crispness to the dates.
Yes, because you're grilling it on the tawa, which is a flat griddle, with very, just bare minimum, oil of any fat.
I'm not talking anymore.
And that sweetness you talk about really speaks to Thanksgiving, because when you think about pecan pie and corn syrup and molasses and the things, and brown sugar, the things we use at Thanksgiving, the dates really fall right into that because they just slip in very easily.
Yeah, totally. This is, if you had somehow made pecan pie part of the appetizer table instead of the dessert table, this is kind of what it's like, only with more heat and spice and complexity. And okay, to be honest, I would love to sit here and keep talking with you because this is fascinating. I love your techniques, but I just want to go eat this now. So thank you for coming in. And happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you.
Same to you.
Vikram Sundaram and David Hagedorn are co-authors with Ashok Bajaj of Rasika, Flavors of India. And I'm serious, that food was incredible. You should have seen like everyone in the studio just fly to it after we wrapped. Or you can watch that happen at your home. Find their recipes for sweet potato samosa purses, cranberry chutney, green bean chili garlic, and butternut squash bharta at splendidtable.org. Now, I know some people don't really want to mess with tradition when it comes with Thanksgiving, and that's fine. I get it. When I was a kid, all I wanted every November was to have a Thanksgiving dinner just like all the other kids. But my parents are from Hong Kong, and where they don't really eat turkey, and where, you know, maple sweet potatoes with marshmallows on top would be too sweet even for dessert, let alone something you'd eat with that dry, dumb bird you don't even want to eat anyway. So I just wanted to belong and to feel normal. And so every year I begged and begged and begged my mom to have turkey, and it just would not happen. And I remember one year was a real low because not only did we not have a turkey for Thanksgiving, we didn't even really have a Thanksgiving because my parents caught wind of the fact that flying on Thanksgiving Day was super cheap, and so we spent the entire day in an airport waiting to take some dumb vacation to Florida. And we sat there with coolers of Chinese food because my parents were terrified they would go anywhere and not find Chinese food. And when we finally got there, it was late and dark, and my mom was microwaving all this rice and food for dinner, and I was so pouty and sour and angry about how Chinese we were. And then she brought out one more box of food, and I couldn't believe what I saw. There was a picture of a red roof on the box with big black letters underneath it, and she goes, "I got you your favorite." And she opened up the box of Pizza Hut spaghetti and meatballs. And I was never more thankful for anything in my life. Coming up, Thanksgiving hacks from America's Test Kitchen and a new look at cider. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Fall is definitely apple season, but you know, it can get kind of overwhelming. You get your pie on, maybe an occasional sauce, but then it's lots of, I don't know, like making pyramids in the fruit bowl or something. But Emma Christensen has an answer for all those apples. Cider. It's incredibly easy to make, the flavors are fascinating, and it's super versatile for both drinking and cooking. It's blowing up in craft brewing circles, but you can get a great batch going in your home today. The New York Times columnist Melissa Clark talked with Emma about the virtues of homemade cider.
Hi, Emma, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So there's been a real explosion in the number of ciders on the market and also in cider making. Why is that?
I would give a lot of the credit to the gluten-free movement, actually. We had the craft beer movement 5-10 years ago that kind of swept across the nation, and all of our gluten-free friends were kind of left out of that. And I think that the craft beer makers and the homebrewers started to realize that, hey, here's this other amazing beverage. Let's make that so everybody can come to the party.
You write that cider making is the gateway into home brewing and winemaking.
Yes. I think that making cider is so easy. I talked to some of my friends who are really excited about getting into fermentation, and they want to brew a batch of beer, they want to brew something, and I just try to steer them toward trying cider first. Beer brewing is fairly complicated, requires a lot of equipment. Cider, you just need a jug of apple juice and some yeast and maybe a couple extra things, but it's a great way to just kind of learn the process, to learn how fermentation happens, and also to get a feel for like the equipment needed, how to use the equipment, how to keep it clean and sanitized. So you basically learn the ropes making cider, and making good cider too, I might add. Like there's no shame in it. It's a great beverage.
It seems like apple juice just wants to ferment. I mean, because I know that when I buy apple cider, even if I leave it in the fridge after a week or so, it's starting to fizz. So take us through the steps of making a super easy beginner's cider.
Sure. So first of all, you need a couple pieces of equipment, and all of this equipment is really easy to get online or at a local home brewing store. Basically, you need a bucket or a jug, something to hold the cider that's a contained system. You'll need something called an airlock, which helps keep the dust and gnats and the stuff you don't want in your cider. The airlock helps keep that out. And then you need a couple other like little tubes and things like that. Nothing too complicated. All told, a kit for making cider costs maybe $30 or so. And then in terms of ingredients, you need apple juice. And you can get your apple juice any number of ways. If you have access to an orchard, you can by all means go and pick apples and press them yourself. You can also buy your apple juice from the farmer's market, from a local farm, or you can go to the grocery store and just buy the best apple juice you can find. You'll need some yeast, which again, you can pick up at the home brewing store. And there are a couple other like little ingredients that help move things along, like some yeast nutrients, some acid blend. If your cider ends up being a little on the sweet side, you can add a little acid to help balance it out. But that's basically it.
Okay, so then you have all of your things gathered, and then what do you do?
Basically, sanitize your bucket or your jug, whatever you're going to put your juice into, add the yeast, close it up, let it sit.
That's it.
That's it.
Wow.
It's literally that easy. Put it somewhere out of the way, room temperature, and just let it sit for anywhere from it'll take about a week of really active fermentation where the yeast are eating up all of the sugars that are in the juice. And then you'll notice it start to kind of slow down. The party starts to fade out. and then you want to let it sit for a little while longer just for any sediment to fall down to the bottom. The yeast eat up the last of the sugars. You just kind of want to give it some chill time. And then once that passes, bottle it up and you're good to go. You're ready to drink, basically.
Now, what if I want to flavor it? If I want to make, you know, spiced cider or ginger cider, mm-hmm. What are some good ways to vary it up?
I love adding spices, fruits, fruit juice. I really like making a chai spice cider where you add in cinnamon and cardamom and fruit, a little bit of honey. You can also use juice. There's a recipe for cherry pomegranate cider, and that is literally just taking cherry juice and pomegranate juice and adding them to the cider.
That must just make it a gorgeous color. You probably have a lot of cider sitting around your house. Now, what do you do with it aside from drink it? Do you use it in cooking? Is there a good way to put it in recipes?
So number one, drink it. And it will stay shelf stable for a really long time. I have some ciders on my shelf from when I very first started experimenting years ago that, gosh, they're probably at least 5 or 6 years old now. And they're even better. They just kind of get better and better. But if you do want to cook with cider, I love using it to deglaze a pan, just like you would use white wine or even a bottle of beer, like the way you'd use beer and chili. You could just add cider instead.
Ooh.
You can also turn it into vinegar, like which is what I do if I get kind of a bum batch of cider where I'm just not happy with the flavor or something just seems a little off. It's not like wrong. It's not infected or anything like that, but it just is not very exciting. Then I just turn it into vinegar, and you get a lot of apple cider vinegar, and that makes great gifts. It's great for cooking with. So yeah, apple cider, you can do a lot with it.
I love the idea that I can actually make apple cider vinegar at home. That's thrilling. Emma, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Emma Christensen is the author of Modern Cider. Melissa Clark's latest book is Dinner in an Instant, and Emma left us with her recipe for basic apple cider. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Every week, we check in with America's Test Kitchen on what they're working on, and this week, it's a million little things to make Thanksgiving dinner just a little easier. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked with ATK's Julia Davison and Bridget Lancaster about some of their favorite holiday hacks.
Hey, Julia and Bridget, so great to have you both here. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you for having us. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Sally.
So we are deep into the cookiness time of year, and I have brought you here as a public service to all of our listeners to whip through some strategies for our Thanksgiving dinner. And I want to start first and foremost. Do we need to truss our turkey or not?
Well, only if you want to be more stressed out. Actually, you do not have
exactly
to
truss, right.
Truss that turkey. No. There's absolutely no reason for that. You know, depending on how you cook your turkey, it's usually in some sort of rack. It actually is a bad idea to tie those legs together. In just about every, you know, part of your life, that's always a good idea not to tie legs together. But especially with the turkey, you don't want to tie the legs together because you want them to actually spread apart a little bit so the heat will get in there. You know, there's that little area between the turkey thigh and the rest of the turkey body that always lags behind in cooking time. So do not truss. That will speed
all
things
right.
up.
That is sweet relief. Okay, Julia, will you tell us what we can make ahead? What do you think?
Yeah, you can make a ton ahead. I think the game changer for me was when I started making gravy ahead of time. I mean, it's amazing. I, for example, this year I'm visiting my folks, and it's about a 6-hour drive. And my mother said, you know, oh, you can't bring anything. I said, oh, yes, I can. I can bring a gallon.
I'm packing gravy.
A gallon of homemade gravy. And it's no matter where, if you're having it at your house or someone else's house, you show up with a gallon of homemade turkey gravy, you're a rock star. Because if you think about the gravy, most people wait until the last minute when the drippings are in the pan during mm-hmm. that time when the turkey's resting. That's like about 45 minutes to an hour. And that is the busiest time of the day. You're trying to get the table done, all the last minute vegetable cookery done, carving the turkey, and you're making gravy, whichever was, you know, it's kind of everyone's favorite part. So make egg gravy, you roast parts, and wings work really well. They're pretty inexpensive, and you can buy them separately at the store with some classic vegetables for, you know, celery and carrots and onion. And then you make a stock, and from that stock, you make a quick gravy, and you can make that now and freeze it.
Yeah, it's a great idea, and that takes a lot of pressure off. What about sweet things? Like, how do you feel about doing breads and rolls and pie dough and stuff before? What's your theory on that, Bridget?
So pie dough, 3 weeks ago, I made it, and it's already rolled out. And I just store it in between pieces of parchment paper, and I stack it in a pizza box that I stole from the local pizzeria.
You roll it out.
Yeah, I already have it rolled out.
I never thought about doing that.
But why do that on the day?
Holy
right?
cow. You just blew my mind right now.
Already
yeah,
rolled
that is
out.
A darn good idea.
So all you have to do is you take out this giant disc of dough, which is frozen, let it sit on the counter maybe 10 minutes, and then it's soft enough to start fitting into the pie plate. Done.
Mm-hmm. And what about stuff for the stuffing?
Well,
what can you do in advance?
So I do cornbread stuffing. So I make the cornbread, mm-hmm. let it stale, let it dry out. I actually toast it a little bit in the oven too, so it can get a little bit brown color. That, and then all the vegetables, actually, the onions and the celery, everything gets cut up ahead of time, chopped, put into a Ziploc bag and frozen.
And you can assemble that stuffing at least the day before.
Mm-hmm.
great idea. Okay, and let's move on to hacks that people may not have thought about to kind of keep the system going, the Thanksgiving system going. Julia, do you have some favorites for this year? I bet you have something with that gravy since you're hauling it.
Totally. The slow cooker. If you have a slow cooker now.
Really?
Yeah, because if you think about it, it's also for the gravy and or the mashed potatoes. I remember I worked for a caterer and I learned to put mashed potatoes in the slow cooker. And then you take little pats of butter and you poke them down into the mashed potatoes. And then when it comes serving time and you go in with a spoon, you get these pockets of melted butter. It's amazing. And sometimes they have little slow cookers meant for dips or cooking for two. Mm-hmm. The smaller one's perfect for keeping gravy warm. And then the dumbest one, I mean, the dumbest hack ever, which is my absolute favorite.
We just set it up.
Yeah.
Irresistible.
So it's Post-its, right? And you pull out all your serving dishes and even serving utensils, and you put a Post-it like this one's for the turkey and this one's for the green beans mm-hmm. and this one's for the mashed potatoes. And what that does is, again, that last hour before the meal or 45 minutes when you're cooking the delicate vegetables, carving the bird, people want to help you. You know, no one wants to see you sweating in the kitchen. They want to help. Yeah. And it makes it easy if they know where to put things. Oh, put the beans on there. Put the mashed potatoes in there. And that way people can help and it comes out the way you want it.
That is super geeky, but it is a really great idea.
Yeah, it's pretty. You have to be kind of on the intense side of Thanksgiving planning. I mean, I do a full-on list with a timeline. People make fun of me. But you know what? Turkey's in the oven. I'm going for a walk with the dogs because I know everything's in place. So
that is unheard of.
Yeah, Julia, laugh all you want.
In the morning, Julia's up with the trumpet and revelry. Like, get up, it's time for Thanksgiving.
Oh, and everyone has a line item on the schedule. Like, you're responsible for trimming the beans and you're responsible for this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Wow.
I think you're a producer at heart.
I'm definitely an over-planner at heart.
Hey, Bridget, you know, people bring wine and they bring white bottles and they're not chilled. Is there a fast way? How do you like to chill it down? How do you drink the wine as fast as you possibly can? That's my question.
Sally, I like the way you think. Hey, what's up with those people bringing warm bottles of wine anyway? We should have a whole separate conversation about that at some point. But, you know, there is a really fast way to chill down a bottle of wine. You know, if you put a bottle of wine in the fridge, it's going to take an hour for it to get down to about 50 mm-hmm. degrees. A much faster way is you wrap it in wet paper towels or actually even better is a kitchen towel and put it in the freezer. It's going to chill down to 50 degrees in 30 minutes. The towel's going to be frozen, just so you know, when you pull it out. But it's the perfect amount of time. And what's happening is that wet towel is wicking away the heat from the bottle of wine. So it's actually a heat transfer as, you know, anytime you cool something, you're taking heat away from it. So the wet towel does a much better job as just the air in the freezer.
I've never heard that trick before. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sally.
Happy Thanksgiving, you too.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Julia Collin Davison and Bridget Lancaster are hosts of the TV shows America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. You can find the recipe for Make Ahead Gravy at splendidtable.org. For about 25 years, Doc Willoughby has led editorial teams at magazines like Gourmet and Cook's Illustrated, which means he's seen probably, I'd say, a few lifetimes worth of Thanksgiving menus and things like this year's hot new way to make mashed potatoes. But with all that experience, I knew I wanted to ask him about some counter-programming. Hey, Doc, thank you so much for joining us in this cozy little studio.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, here's a hypothetical situation. This has never happened. But let's say it's Thanksgiving. Turkey's done. It's actually the weekend after Thanksgiving, but I still have family in town I still need to feed. Like, they are still my responsibility. That giant turkey and all the sides and all the sandwiches were not enough. They still need to eat food. What should I make them?
You should make them my grandmother's lazy Sunday pot roast. Because it is as easy as it sounds and nobody doesn't like it.
Okay. This is literally your grandmother's pot roast?
This is literally my grandmother's pot roast. When my grandmother died, I inherited her recipe book, which I was just starting to get into food. And so I was quite excited about this because in our family, my grandmother was the cook. I mean, I was raised in rural Iowa in the 50s and 60s, which is a time of where we were still trying to get over the way people started cooking back then. Because back then, anything canned or frozen was considered superior to anything fresh. Mm. It was modern, it was easy, it was trendy. So my father had a huge garden, but my mother refused to cook anything out of it because she preferred the canned and the frozen. But my grandmother was exactly the opposite. She raised four children on a farm before the days of electricity and running water. So every single thing that they ate, except for flour, sugar, lemons, things like that, she made. They raised it, they butchered it, and they made it on the farm. So she was a truly local cook, and she cooked three meals a day for 40, 50 years. Wow. So she was a great cook, and we loved going to her house for dinner. So when she died, I got her cookbook, and it wasn't a book of printed recipes. It was a book of blank pages that she could write her recipes on, and mm-hmm. then there were little pockets labeled meat, fish, bread, like that.
Yeah.
And they were all stuffed full of her little handwritten recipes. So I started looking through there and was a little disappointed because all the things that she made all the time that I loved, like fried chicken and mashed potatoes with cream tomato gravy and apple pie and pickled crab apples, no recipes for those. Because why would she need recipes for those? She'd been making them her entire life. But there were a few very interesting recipes, and I pulled this one out because it was labeled Lazy Sunday Pot Roast. Now, my grandmother was anything but lazy.
When she was
in her late 80s, she was still taking food to those poor shut-ins who were like 20 years younger than she was. So, but I wanted to see what she considered a lazy pot roast. And so I started looking at it, and it was super easy. There are like eight ingredients, but they were weird. I mean, these were things I had never seen in a pot roast before. So first of all, instead of potatoes and carrots, the things you usually have in a pot roast, there were apples.
Hmm.
Yeah, so she had a little orchard of Baldwin apples on her farm, so she called for Baldwin apples. And then there was a tablespoon of caraway seeds, which is, you know, I had only known caraway seeds as something you put in baked goods, right?
Right.
So a tablespoon.
Rye bread or whatever.
Yeah, like that, you know. And then there was marjoram, which she did cook with marjoram, but I don't remember exactly what she used it in. So there are these three ingredients that seemed completely out of place in a pot roast. Hmm. So I thought, well, I had got to make this, both because of the title and because it was weird, you know, and weird can be good.
Sure.
So I made it. It was completely simple. Really, you know, chopping up the apples is the hardest thing you have to do. And then you sit it in the oven for 3 hours and you're done. And it was amazing. It's got the sweetness from the apples. It's got the marjoram is a lot more aromatic. And a lot of people say you can use oregano instead, but it's not the same. It's much more sweeter and floral and aromatic. And then you've got the caraway seeds, which are earthy and kind of licorice-y. So these are not the taste you usually associate with pot roast, right? But I have made it, I can't even tell you how many times since then. It's become my go-to dish for when I want to make something that feeds a crowd that I know everybody will like. But it's something, unless they've been to my house, they probably haven't had before, right? So it has become my go-to dish, and no one I made it for has ever not liked it. And it was probably the nicest gift my grandmother could have given me.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you for letting me share it.
John Doc Willoughby is a writer and editor. You can find his grandmother's pot roast recipe at splendidtable.org. And coming up, I get to talk with you. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, let's talk. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Pick up that phone, 1-800-537-5252. Our voicemail is always on. We want to know what you're thinking about. All right, we have Natalie on the line from Oakland, California. Hey, Natalie, how are you?
Hi, Francis. So I wanted to talk about my Thanksgiving menu. So for as long as I can remember, my family has done a pretty traditional Thanksgiving menu, which is great. But this year, we're going to have a slightly smaller guest list. And so I was hoping that you could help me get a little bit more creative, or maybe even a little bit more ambitious. We were thinking of doing an Italian menu.
So the idea is you want to have an Italian menu that references flavors of traditional American Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And I have to tell you, the very first thing I'm thinking about is like a sweet potato gnocchi with brown butter and sage. And if you haven't made it, I mean, I would consult recipes, but off the top of my head, basically, what you want to do is you want to cook a bunch of sweet potato. Either you roast it whole in the skin or you can boil it. You take out all the sweet potato flesh. you can puree it, or you can, you know, put it through a food mill, or just use an old-fashioned potato masher. It will be a little more rustic that way. And you kind of sprinkle on enough flour, just enough flour, for you to be able to sort of form it into a dough. And okay. Try not to work it too hard. Cut it into chunks. Roll it out into, you know, into inch thick or so, you know, snakes. That's the word I'm using, snakes, because I don't have other words.
Yeah, I can picture that.
Yeah, and then cut off little like 1-inch pieces. You could boil those up really quick, take them out of the water, drain them nice and dry, and then you get a big pan. Just go nuts on it. It's Thanksgiving, right? Just go nuts on the butter. You let it melt, let it get nice and brown, so it's a nice nutty brown, you know, like really, like, you know, don't be soft with it. And then you throw in a bunch of sage leaves, maybe some nice chopped walnuts is a great, I mean, this is a very typical dish, but I'm just saying all those flavors just feel so Thanksgiving-y to me. And then you take that sweet potato gnocchi and you drop it in there, and you give them a little bit of a crisp on one side, or just warm it through with that beautiful butter, good lot of salt and cheese, and boom, there it's, I mean, that's
you really
a side dish,
wrong.
It's a main dish, it's a, yeah, that's, I mean, that's just carb fat heaven. That sounds awesome to me. What else?
That sounds delicious.
So do you want to do turkey, or do you want to do like...
Yes, I was going to mention, we're not tethered to turkey at all. And I mean, I know that they eat turkey in Italy, but this is an opportunity to branch out.
Yeah, because I'm thinking maybe you can do almost like a porchetta. I mean, maybe you want to just straight up do a porchetta,
which is
a beautiful, like, basically, there are lots of ways to do it. Not the most traditional way, but sort of the most home-friendly way is to take a nice big piece of pork belly, smear a flavorful paste on the inside of herbs, and roll it up and then roast it. And keeping in the Italian mode, maybe those herbs are fennel and rosemary, or I'm also thinking like raisins are kind of Thanksgiving-y. Yeah. You feel like raisins feel like Thanksgiving-y?
Yeah, I know. I was trying to think about how to incorporate cranberries, but raisins would be a really similar
idea. Oh, I love that.
Idea.
No, I love that. Cause I was thinking raisins, and then raisins makes me think of Sicily. So oranges and olives, but cranberries would be great. So dried cranberries instead of the raisins, maybe a little orange zest, maybe even a little bit of orange juice. Hey, chop up some orange fruit and maybe put that in the smear. Some chopped olives. Salt it up well. Ooh. Roll that guy up and roast that. Or do the same thing but with like turkey legs. Like take a nice turkey leg, maybe have it deboned and flattened out. Because those things get pretty big. Like a turkey thigh, like you can, if you're like butterflying that out or asking your butcher to butterfly out a turkey leg for you, those things get pretty big and you can do like maybe a series of them. Maybe you could do like, you know, maybe one per two people or something like that. And so you can actually have turkey.
Yeah, we're gonna have about 10, so it's doable.
Yeah. So do that. Like do that beautiful, good cranberry, orange, and olive kind of smear on the inside, the meat side of the turkey leg. Salt it well on both sides. Roll it up. Tie it up. Give it a little bit of brown in a pan just to start getting the skin going. Roast it off. Maybe five or six of those, and you have your gnocchi. That sounds like a great dinner.
I could eat that right now. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, some nice salad. And, you know, it's Thanksgiving, so go nuts. You can make all kinds of different sides and stuff. But
yeah, exactly.
Does that sound like fun? That sounds like fun to me.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I'll let you know how it goes. Thanks so much for your help.
Oh, my pleasure. Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Thanks, Francis.
All right, talk to you soon. Oh, I should have mentioned this. Lynn has a great Italian-American Thanksgiving menu on our website, splendidtable.org. Hi, we have Kathleen on the line from Venice, California. Hey, Kathleen, how are you?
Hey, Francis, how are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. What would you like to talk about?
This year, I'm hosting a large Friendsgiving for a bunch of friends and also hosting a small family Thanksgiving. I do my best to try to buy ethically responsible food, so I actually purchased a small heritage turkey for my family Thanksgiving, and it was about $15 a pound. I definitely cannot afford that for the Friendsgiving. So, so I'm trying to think if there's any alternatives. You know, maybe the best thing to do is just, don't do a turkey.
Well, actually, you know what? So I was digging into the history, and is it going to blow your mind to know that the original Thanksgiving, that is like with the colonists and the Wampanoag tribe at Plymouth Plantation, they didn't eat turkey.
That does blow my mind.
So turkey was not actually part of the, you know, quote unquote, original Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So that kind of opens you up, right? And you can think about other things. And what they actually did eat at that celebration were lots of foods that the natives had shown the colonists, you know, this is what you can hunt for here, this is what you can forage for, this is what you can grow here. So lots of corn, squash, probably beans. And in terms of proteins, like meats and fish, they ate cod, they ate lobster, which probably doesn't help you for your cost issue, and they ate venison. But if you want to go in the bird direction, they ate lots of birds, just like whatever small birds they can, you know, get their hands on, right? So probably they ate pheasant. Again, doesn't help you, but they ate duck. And it may not be that much cheaper per pound, but it's so rich. We don't necessarily need to serve as much per person. And
I really like what you said about really any birds. That way no one can dock me for doing really great roast chickens or something.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they ate chicken, because I think chicken's typically domesticated, and these were mainly, like, you know, wild birds they would have hunted. But yeah, that's a technicality, right? Like you,
right.
I mean, the thing I would say to you, honestly, how do you set up your table? Is everyone around a table, or is it like a buffet style? You said it was sort of a big group.
Yeah, so it's going to be buffet style with a big group, and there's going to be a lot of other dishes there. Someone's bringing some ham. So I don't think that the whatever protein I replace the turkey with has to necessarily be the cornerstone of everybody's meal.
Oh, beautiful. And can I give you a little bit of a caterer's secret? Okay, so two things. If you have like a precious item that you want people to enjoy for sure, like you're not like trying to, you know, not be a great host, but you want to sort of control the portioning a little bit, there are a few things. You can use smaller plates, because people will naturally put less food on a smaller plate and they will come back. You should encourage them to come back, but that's sort of like the psychology of that. You can put the item that you maybe have a little bit less of at the end of the table, so people have already filled their plate up by the time they got there. And if you pre-slice, you can slice it pretty thin. And, you know, people will just naturally take, like, I'll just take two or three pieces, you know, no big deal. And so you can help people along with their sort of unconscious portioning.
Right. I really love that tip. That's definitely not just a Thanksgiving thing. I love to host, so that I can definitely put into place all the time.
Yeah. And then hopefully they don't hear this. And be like, oh, I see what Kathleen's trying to do.
Awesome. Thank you.
And enjoy your Thanksgiving and your Friendsgiving.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye. And remember, you can call us anytime. Questions or thoughts, 1-800-537-5252. Or email us through our website, splendidtable.org. Rebecca Lehrer is a Salvadoran Jewish-American woman from Los Angeles. And Amy Choi is a Korean-American mother to two Korean, Colombian, Mexican-American kids. With all those hyphens to tell the story of where they're from, they host a podcast called The Mashup Americans, where they talk to people around our country about their hyphen stories. And they're here to talk about a special holiday for a little-known saint, the Feast of San Givin. So Amy, Rebecca, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So, I have a few years of Catholic school under my belt, actually.
Oh, but wow.
Catholic school and I go way back.
More on that later.
But you celebrate the feast day of a saint that I have never heard of. So who is San Givin?
Well, he's the projection of all of our American dreams. No, in fact, it's just, you know, so many Latinos are Catholic, although I this is Rebecca, and I happen to be a Latin Jew, but many are Catholic. And so, you know, you come to the States and you hear people talking about Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving. And so you're putting it through this sort of Spanish, Spanglish lens and you hear, oh, it's Thanksgiving.
Oh, so we're all getting together. We're going to eat.
Thanksgiving. So, yeah, we're going to eat pavo. It's the patron saint of pavo.
The patron saint of pavo.
So Thanksgiving is really sort of this idea of how we as new Americans kind of come to embrace and celebrate Thanksgiving.
So, Rebecca, you said your family comes from...
My mom is from El Salvador. She's a Salvadoran Jew, and my dad's family is from Vienna and Poland. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
And Amy, your family is from?
The Republic of Korea. I was the first person born here. My parents immigrated in the 70s when that big old wave of Korean immigrants, the first wave, came into the U.S. So when we celebrated Thanksgiving, it wasn't the patron saint for us because I have no Latino background in me. But, I mean, I think for us, Thanksgiving was always, like, it was the American holiday. Like, yeah. There was, and we didn't have necessarily, like, a deep understanding of what it signified or meant, even only that it was a time when Americans came together around a table, and we were now American. So this is what mm-hmm. we did. And so I think about it, like, you know, all of our other holidays, like, we were, like, kind of Christian, but not really the way that I think a lot of the Korean community is in the U.S. And like Christmas and Easter, all those days we ate Korean food. Sure. Like that was like kalbichim and like taengjeong jjigae and banchan. And like Thanksgiving, we had stovetop stuffing and instant mashed potatoes because that was American.
Oh.
It was like we were performing Americanness in my family as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, because it was just the only non-Jewish holiday that we really celebrated. Yeah. So it was like, well, this is what Americans do.
Like you didn't have to go to synagogue on Thanksgiving.
Exactly. Yeah. And I loved it because, I mean, even though I actually love the ritual of many prayers and religious things, I loved it because it was the one holiday where you simply just ate. Like there wasn't like a 4-hour Seder.
Yeah. But then there's also still this sort of cultural idea of what's supposed to be on that table.
Exactly.
At least for, you know, a lot of families, you know, places, including my own. That table looks pretty different.
Totally.
So I'd love to hear what was on your Thanksgiving tables when you grown up.
I think my parents, what they created for us was really a part of like integrating into Americanness. Yeah. So we did the turkey, and it wasn't like a soy glazed turkey or like a miso glaze. It was just turkey. It was stovetop stuffing. It was instant mashed potatoes because like we didn't cook potatoes anytime other than Thanksgiving. So we didn't know how. But then also like all the accoutrement was like my dad had to eat gochujang with his turkey.
Which
like,
is the
Korean
bean chili sauce.
Exactly. And then, you know,
it was like there was a whole array of banchan, right?
Right. And there was no...
Which are the Korean snacks?
Side dishes. but yeah, it's like, you know, we didn't have bread on the table. It was always white rice, banchan, gochujang, soy sauce.
Like kimchi and little marinated vegetables.
Exactly.
And you had that turkey.
But then also turkey.
And Rebecca?
You know, similarly, it was sort of as I said, it was kind of a performance of Americanness in some way. So we would come and be like, this is the turkey. And then we couldn't not have rugelach or something for dessert, right? It was somehow like, well, I also stopped at Cantor's Deli just because, you know, you never know if you're going to need it, right?
Like, so I actually have a question. Yeah. Is that it wasn't until like hanging out with white people as an adult and like having celebratory meals that like I learned that you could like carve a bird and make it beautiful. And that was a thing that people did.
Oh.
Like we had a cleaver. Like you would chop through
like
the
bird. Like Asian cleaver. Yeah. And you would chop it like you would like when you go to.
Like a duck.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That's exactly right.
Was that your experience, Francis?
Well, my experience is that my family comes from China. And, you know, turkey is not really a thing there at all. And, you know, my parents love succulents. And sort of like. I don't know what the deal with this holiday is. It seems cool. The kids are off from school, but like we're not eating a turkey. Why would you make yourself eat a turkey when there are other actual delicious things to eat?
You know, it's funny because I think a lot of our fans and readers of the Mashup Americans have sent us their wonderful family recipes. So actually, you know, a friend Paige, she likes to say I'm Chinatown Chinese. So she's a few generations American, but from San Francisco, Chinatown. Her family has this fabulous soy, you know, marinated turkey. And then our Puerto Rican friend who has this guava adobado turkey. And then there's a sticky rice stuffing. There's people who you know, a lot of mashups really do take it and interpret it while still, you still have to work within some constraint of ingredients.
But I really, I mean, I so appreciate that. And if there is like one last thing that I think we would really want to impart is that we believe in creating culture every day.
Right.
That like just by living, we're creating a new culture. And by having deep roots and carrying them forward into the new families that we're making, like maybe you make your daughter turkey or maybe not, or maybe it's a beautiful bird infused with the flavors of like your traditions of like Hong Kong flavors. And that, like, that's incredible, right? Like we get to do it because we have access to all of these things.
Yeah.
And they're all equally American.
Absolutely.
Amen. Yeah. We're grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. I'm hungry now.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Rebecca Lehrer and Amy Choi are hosts of the podcast, The Mashup Americans. And that's our show for the week. Thank you for spending the time with us. And until next week, eat well, drink well, and please tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thank you, as always, to everyone who contributes and makes this show possible. We literally cannot do it without you. So to help support our show, please go to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and subscribe to our podcasts. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell and assistant producer Erica Romero. Jenny Lupke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.